This is Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG for December 26th. I'm your host, Dave Benninger. Thanks for joining us. Coming up, we'll take a look at some ambitious projects underway in Port Hyden, plus a look back at the history of reindeer in Bristol Bay, some tips for healthy New Year's resolutions from the Diabetes Program, and Elijah Hunt tells us what movies we must see this week. First, a look back at some of the week's news. On Monday, Dillingham Police announced that most of last week's burglaries had been solved. Break-ins at the LFS store, boats in the harbor, and airlines at the airport had occurred starting last Wednesday, and an expensive generator was stolen from L&M downtown. Two of three suspects have been named and subsequently arrested. Acting Chief Sergeant Rodney Etheridge commented on whether or not the spike in petty crime was related to drugs in town.
That's not far off the mark. The motive in both of these cases was the mainly abused substance in Dillingham, which is alcohol. That was what the generator was sold for.
Recovery teams searching for bodies of two people in the Kuskokwim River shed will have sonar equipment and specialists helping as the ice continues to thicken. It was announced this week that a Wisconsin-based nonprofit that helps locate drowning victims plans to bring underwater side-scan sonar to look for the bodies near Queefluck. Two of three from a missing ATV have still not been found. The U.S. Census Bureau released population estimates this week, and the 49th state slipped to 48th out of the 50 in the most populous state rankings. Alaska was bumped down a spot by North Dakota, which saw a growth of an estimated 16,000 people last year, while Alaska's population dropped by just over 500. Alaska was one of six states to lose population last year. On Christmas Eve, we learned that a batch of seal oil from Twin Hills was contaminated with botulism and it hospitalized several people from Southwest Alaska communities. The oil was particularly potent, according to the state's testing, and as Dr. Kathy Hyman from Kanakanak told us, the outbreak was more widespread than usual.
The epidemiologist with whom I spoke said it was the largest outbreak that he's worked with in his time in Alaska.
Several were being monitored as of Wednesday, with two people hospitalized in Anchorage and under respiratory care. Well, now that Christmas is over, how many plates of cookies are still laying around? We begin to set our sights on the new year and perhaps some resolutions to make for healthier or happier living. In Bristol Bay, nearly 300 people have type 1 or type 2 diabetes, and over 200 are known to be in the pre-diabetes range, meaning without some lifestyle choices, they may well become diabetic in the years ahead. The number of people who have pre-diabetes is growing, which Commander Lois Schumacher, the Diabetes Program Coordinator at the Kanakanak Hospital, says is concerning. I spoke with her this morning for some advice for all of us about improving our health and keeping diabetes at bay as we look to 2015.
Activity is the number one thing that we can do to decrease our risk for type 2 diabetes or pre-diabetes. The recommendation is doing 30 to 40 minutes of any sort of activity that increases our heart rate and creates a sweat, and then to do that on most days.
I've heard you mention before things like digging out a snow machine, that counts, or chopping firewood, that counts. Do you still stand by those suggestions?
Right. Like brisk walking, anything that gets that heart rate up. If you have to dig out your snow machine, great. Shoveling is great. Chopping wood, playing basketball, any type of activity that gets that heart rate up. The thing that the exercise does is by increasing our heart rate, we are increasing our circulation, and we're stimulating hormones in our body that may kind of be dormant. And that helps to lower the cholesterol as well as stimulating the insulin that we may already have on board. And insulin is what attaches to our muscle cells and lets the sugar from the blood go into our muscles to give us energy and therefore lowers the blood sugar level in the blood.
Exercise is certainly one of the main priorities, but I gather that diet is important and probably tobacco use and alcohol maybe even as well. What do you think about those?
Well, healthy eating for sure. You know, we're promoting choosemyplate.gov, which, you know, we no longer have the food pyramid now, but we have the plate method.
So this is new from what many of us learned back in elementary school.
Right. They're different, and they're making us look at our plate a little bit differently. You know, so making a quarter of our plate with the fruit, and fruit can be frozen, canned, or fresh, it doesn't matter. If it's canned, they're asking us to drain it, lightly rinse it, get off some of the excess sugars. Same with the vegetables. A quarter of our plate should be filled with vegetables. It can be fresh, frozen, or canned. If it's canned, they're asking us to drain it, lightly rinse it, get rid of the excess salt or the sodium. Then a quarter of our plate should be grains, making whole grains. The more whole grains that we have, the more fiber, helps to reduce our cholesterol, helps to stabilize our blood sugar level, decreases our risk for certain types of cancer. And then a quarter of our plate should be protein. Protein should be no more than the size of our palm, and making that protein lean, and then the methods that we're using to cook that protein, making sure that those are lean, low fat as well. And then our dairy should be low fat as well, you know, low fat milk or non-fat milk or low fat yogurt.
Lois, can you give us all a little pep talk for making our New Year's resolutions?
Yeah, I think setting small goals, you know, working on something very small that would make a big difference. A lot of folks that we see are drinking a lot of excess sugars. You know, they're drinking, instead of eating their sugars, they're drinking them. So they're drinking a lot of soda pop, a lot of Tang, a lot of Kool-Aid. You know, getting rid of those high sugar drinks and choosing water instead is one big step that a lot of us can really do. And then just by cutting out a lot of the high sugar drinks helps us to lose weight throughout the year.
Well, thank you so much, Lois. Talk to you again soon.
Okay, thank you.
Commander Lois Schumacher coordinates the diabetes program at the Conackamack Hospital in Dillingham. The plucky little village of Port Hyden on the Alaska Peninsula is embarking on a pair of ambitious projects right now. They hope that their efforts will create more jobs, more income, and more food security for the village of just over 100 residents. I was in Port Hyden last week, courtesy of a seat on a BBEDC chartered plane. John Christensen gave me a tour, first driving me out to a fish processing plant the village is now building. We drove down a dirt road the village is building directly to the plant.
It was a trail here. We just improved it, but there is a road going around, and it would take 20 minutes to get out here, so now it takes two.
Along the road, several earth movers and trucks are taking advantage of the warm, dry December day to keep improving the road, which will serve as the main route from the village to the plant. I asked why the state wasn't building the road for the village.
We did it ourselves, because if we waited for the state or the government to help us out, it would take too long. We wouldn't be able to get our processing plant done in time.
That attitude, not always commonplace elsewhere, is ubiquitous in Port Hyden. Every able-bodied person is a trained hazwoper and able to work on the lucrative Air Force cleanup projects nearby. There are windmills popping up on houses. When the sea began to claim two giant old fuel holding tanks too close to the eroding shore, a few people built a trailer, raised them up, and hauled them out. Hazwoppers cleaned them, and now one has been recycled as a hangar and the other as the new village recycling depot. Christensen and many others in Port Hyden are not shy about their go-get-em attitude.
We're basically left to ourselves. If we don't do it, nobody else is going to do it for us.
When we arrive at the new fish processing plant, which has been built out of an old boat storage facility, we find more young people hard at work. Christensen says they're making some more progress than expected.
The weather's been good, so we've been able to pour some in for a long time. We're going to be done by springtime.
We step in to look at the new facility, which is large and so far pretty bare.
All right, now we're inside. What are we looking at here?
We're renovating this boathouse, turning it into our CAS fish processing plant. We added on a 60 by 60 hangar, and then we're going to add on another building.
The key word in his statement is CAS, or CAS, which stands for Cells Alive System. It's a brand of freezers developed in Japan which purport to keep food frozen without destroying the cells from the outside in, as in no freezer burned fish. The inventor, Norio Awada, was dubbed Mr. Freeze by Forbes magazine in 2008, and his freezers, which use a magnetic field and apparently other proprietary techniques, are finding their way to restaurants, processors, and hospitals around the world. Awada claims his freezers at the right setting can preserve almost anything and keep it fresh as the day it was frozen for years, even traditionally hard-to-freeze products like milk and cream, fruits and vegetables, and even human tissue and organs. Christensen tells me that several from Port Hyden made the trip to visit Owada in Japan this year, and that the 70-year-old Japanese inventor came to Port Hyden as well. They say Owada sees Cass as the future of preserving salmon, and also that he hopes it could be a means to a brighter economic future for villages like Port Hyden. When they visited, Christensen says they sampled a sea bass that had been frozen for 5 years, and he says it tasted as fresh as one that had just been caught that day. He says it seemed too good to be true, and he might be skeptical if he hadn't seen it with his own eyes and tasted various samples himself.
Mr. Owada, Norio Owada, he's been working on this for 30 to 40 years. We went to Japan and met up with him at his laboratory, and we were very excited about the vegetables, because the vegetables, you could freeze them and then unthaw them, then they're not soggy, they're still crisp. Then he was happy that we were happy about the vegetables and not about money.
Using this cast freezer, which they hope to take delivery of in the spring, Christensen hopes to see the 5 or 6 permit holders deliver the majority of their catch to be processed at the village plant next year. They are working to develop markets in Japan for now, where consumers may want the whole fish, head, guts, and all. Right now, they're hoping to process and deliver somewhere between 1 and 500,000 pounds of sockeye in 2015. That's a modest goal for the first year, and they see a lot of hurdles to cross between now and then, but they're already getting excited about the longer-term goals.
This is just a start. Our plan here is to, this is a pilot project. After we do this, we'll be able to get funding to put one in every village.
They think that a CAS freezer would allow more villages to process their own catch, perhaps even thawing the catch after the season slows, processing it further, and refreezing it before shipping to market. It's ambitious, but they and a lot of others are hoping for success. Christensen then drove me out to another village project. We stopped along the gate of a giant new corral assembled this past fall, which is waiting on delivery of 64 reindeer from Stebbins and St. Michael in the weeks ahead.
They'll come in one end and then get castrated, tagged, inoculated, and then out the other end. And so it shouldn't be a problem with bringing predators into town.
That Port Hyden is embarking on reindeer herding, a practice that was dropped circa 1940 for a variety of reasons, has drawn the attention of many, and not all positive. Fish and Game is leery of problems of reindeer and caribou mixing or competing for resources. Fish and Wildlife and the National Park Service are fairly confident these reindeer will migrate onto nearby federal lands. For those in Port Hyden, who haven't been allowed to hunt caribou for a decade, they say the reindeer represent not just a potential economic boom, i.e. butchering and processing and cast freezing the product for sale to market, but also a meat source for those in the village.
But we want to keep some around, so just in case anything happens, we'd have food security. Because it's a big issue everywhere, because a lot of places, they don't have their own source of food. Everybody got to bring something in.
Christensen points out towards the nearby peaks, which he says are on federal lands, and suggests that trained herders will keep the reindeer this side of those peaks on village and state lands. I ask if he's concerned about the pushback from state and federal officials.
Well, I don't see them out here feeding us. And they don't come down here to check on us. We're pretty much left to our own devices.
The village will need permits if they let reindeer out of the corral to graze on state and village lands in the vicinity. He admits that some state officials are expressing skepticism about this ambitious undertaking.
Some of them are kind of concerned, but we'll just have to talk about that when the reindeer are here.
He says they expect to take possession of those reindeer in the weeks ahead. Crates have been built and a plane has been chartered, and the 64 reindeer have been purchased. Now they're waiting on herders in Stebbins and St. Michael to round them up and prepare them for transport. These two projects and a host of smaller ones are Port Hyden's way of drafting their own future, bucking the trend of standing by and watching the village fold up as numbers dwindle, permits disappear, and schools close.
Yeah, we're the place that I've always been, just like what BBNC says. And we want to always will be here. I don't want to go away.
That's John Christensen speaking last Thursday afternoon on an unusually calm and clear day in the village of Port Hyden. Well, reindeer herding, as many know, has a storied past in Bristol Bay, and this past is being restudied by researchers in the anthropology department at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Postdoctoral fellow Amber Lincoln is among those who has been sifting through archives and gathering oral history to better document the history of reindeer on the Alaska Peninsula. She and others presented some of their findings recently at the Katmai National Park and Preserve Office in King Salmon. Bristol Bay reindeer were an offshoot of Sheldon Jackson's reindeer experiment initiative around the turn of the century. I spoke with Lincoln earlier this week for more. Amber, thanks for joining.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you.
Well, let's start with Sheldon Jackson's project along these lines. How did he influence the idea that reindeer made their way to Bristol Bay?
Well, at the turn of the 20th century, the 1890s, there was concern that caribou populations were low and people didn't have enough to eat. So Sheldon Jackson and a few other people kind of came up with this idea that they would bring reindeer from Chukotka over to Alaska and teach Alaska natives how to reindeer herd because, of course, you know, it wasn't too far away on the other side of the Bering Strait, where people were, in fact, reindeer herders. And so by 1892, reindeer were brought to Teller on the Seward Peninsula, and Alaska Native people signed on as apprentices and worked with first Chukchi herders. And then when they couldn't really get along with Chukchi herders, Sheldon Jackson brought in Sami herders from Norway, sometimes referred to as Laplanders. And basically, reindeer herding spread pretty quickly in the early years. And so it moved, you know, north to the Barrow region and south down to Bethel and the Kuskokwim. So in 1904, you know, Sheldon Jackson wanted to continue spreading reindeer herding throughout the state. And he had an idea of moving reindeer into Copper Center, you know, north of Valdez. So he hired Sami and Yupik herders from the Kuskokwim region to drive 300 reindeer over the Alaska Range into Copper Center. But the herders couldn't make it. They got, you know, stuck with the Alaskan Range and in rangeland where there was nothing for the reindeer to eat. So eventually, the herders with, you know, the roughly 300 animals settles on the southern shore of Lake Ilyamna in Reindeer Bay, which is very close to Kakanak.
So I guess in a sense, reindeer sort of ended up in Bristol Bay for the first time unplanned.
Absolutely. So it was an accident. It was a total accident that reindeer ended up in Bristol Bay. And it's kind of a fortuitous accident because when reindeer were brought in, you know, 1905, the caribou herds at that time were pretty low. So reindeer weren't immediately competing with, you know, with caribou for rangeland and vegetation.
Lincoln says people took readily to the industry. Schools were established and communities took to the idea of the work and the new but familiar food source. Then the reindeer and their herders began to spread downriver.
The reindeer would propagate very quickly. You know, those 300 reindeer became 700. And by 1909, so, you know, 4 years later, reindeer herders and administrators decided that they wanted to set up a reindeer station at in Kagyang. So they moved 500 reindeer down the Kwijak River and set up a station at Kagyang, which we think it seems like it was more the station was set up to move reindeer both into the Dillingham region and then south down toward Ugashik, and reindeer were moved then to Kodiak Island and such.
This was certainly something that the government had an interest in doing, and what was the government's role in these early days?
So it's interesting. So initially, you know, people were very concerned when, you know, Sheldon Jackson was a Presbyterian missionary as well as the general agent for education of Alaska. He thought that at the time, I mean, he definitely wanted to make food available for people that he did think were lacking food.
But it was also an acculturation experiment. So basically, the thinking at the time was that it was this evolutionary thinking where, you know, you had hunters on the bottom of the rung, and then you had agriculturalists on the top of the rung. They were the most sophisticated based on this thinking. And so the idea was, well, let's turn these hunters into pastoralists, and they will be, you know, more civilized. That was the idea. It was this acculturation. Let's turn them into American citizens, make them entrepreneurial pastoralists rather than subsistence hunters.
Lincoln says government stations were established in Kogiong, Ugashik, Wood River, and Eagle Bay on Lake Iliamna. Young men were hired as apprentices, and they became head herders, and after four years, they could take the reindeer they had earned, often 30 to 40 animals, and leave to become private herders.
One example is Marianne Olympics of Igiagic. Her father was a herder, Alexei Gregory, in Kukakalik Lake, and he apprenticed in Kogiong, and then when he finished, he moved his reindeer up to the lake there, Kukakalik Lake, and herded for many years. In fact, he herded for one of the longest until 1947. But what happened is, and in fact, then we should also mention that in 1931, Sami herders from the Kuskokwim moved, you know, it sounds like it could have been 2,000 reindeer into South Naknak. And they ranged those deer between South Naknak and Igigik and a little bit of the Sheriff Lake and sold meat to, you know, residents of Naknak and some to the canneries. But what happened is in 1937, the Sami lost their reindeer with the Reindeer Act of 1937, which stated that only Alaska Natives could own and manage reindeer.
So the government, she says, bought out the Sami herd after the passage of that act. And about that time, many others were realizing the economic potential of the fishing industry growing up rapidly around them.
Fishing was so lucrative. You know, people could earn more money fishing in 1 month than they could herding for a whole year. And you can imagine how much time it would take to be a reindeer herder. You know, you couldn't always leave the herds or they would be eaten by wolves. They might run off with other caribou herds. It just became economically, you know, unviable is the short story.
Slowly, the remaining herds dwindled. Several winters in the 1930s had freeze-thaw cycles that buried the lichen under layers of ice that were hard for reindeer to dig to, crippling some of the herds near Pilot Point. And other problems began to mount in the 1930s and 40s as well.
There was mismanagement. There was a difficulty between trying to figure out rangelands, trying to keep, you know, reindeer separated from one another by, you know, by different owners. Up in New Haven, there was complaints that there was just massive amounts of wolves. So these are the kinds of stories that we read about both in the archives and that we hear from people. So a number of variables, you know, came together to dwindle the reindeer herds in the late 30s. And then it just wasn't worth people's time. And so they kind of let them go. And those reindeer joined caribou herds. They were eaten by wolves. They died. They were hunted. You know, any number of things happened to them.
Lincoln and her colleagues have been sifting through archives and, more importantly, talking to people in villages from Port Hyden to Naknek and all around Lake Iliamna. With a clearer picture of the history of the reindeer experiment, I asked if a fresh look at the history held any verdict on its success or failure.
You know, I think, no doubt, you know, there's a bit of both, right? Like, you know, for the people, for the families who were reindeer herders, I mean, of course it was a success. You know, it's just, I mean, as an industry, yeah, no, it's not a long-term industry that lasted in the Bristol Bay region. But look what it's brought to that area. You know, so many people have these great stories and memories of herding or of their parents and grandparents talking about herding. And, you know, all of these potential opportunities in the future. You know, I think this history has given people, like in Port Hyden, the notion that they could possibly reindeer herd.
Are there any lessons learned from the past experiment that may benefit people if they do try it again here?
I think there are very many, yes. And there were a lot of problems, right, clearly in that history of with reindeer herding. And these are very different times. And it's always good in anything we do, right? It's always good to look at how things were done in the past and how that might help us in the future. I think anybody interested in reindeer herding most definitely should think about and look at the past and look at this history.
We'll post a link with this segment to the project that Lincoln and her colleagues have been working on, which has more on the history of Bristol Bay reindeer. And we'll end this week's Bristol Bay and Beyond with our student intern, Elijah Hunt, who has been keeping an eye on entertainment and joins us now for a look at what's coming soon to theaters in the big city and, more importantly, what's out on DVD here for us. Elijah, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. A lot of things have been coming out this month. It's been a big month for entertainment. So many exciting things.
What's exciting to you? What are you watching? What do you want to see?
The one I really want to see right now is Big Hero 6. It just looks like a really funny, amazing comedy action family movie.
Is this the sixth installment in that series?
No, it's based off a Marvel comic of the same name. It's in the comic, there's six. It's a group of six people, so
okay.
Big Hero 6.
But okay. And if I'm not mistaken here, this is a family-friendly title.
Yes, it is.
Okay, so something the folks can rent. Is this coming out on DVD or in the movie theaters?
It's in the movie theaters right now, coming out on DVD in February.
All right, so a lot of the folks traveling in may take the kids to see Big Hero 6.
Yep.
Okay. What's coming out on DVD?
Maze Runner's coming out. I think it's out right now on DVD.
What is this movie? I've seen the disc cover.
I don't know much about it, honestly. It just looks like so action-packed. It's full of mystery and action. And
all right.
It just has a good-looking cast as well.
Rating?
It's rated PG-13.
Okay, so another title that you can pick up at the AC.
Yep.
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
That's coming out as well. I think that's out, actually. That's at AC at
the moment. Have you seen this yet?
I have.
Is it any good?
It's pretty good. It's
now, have you seen the originals
that
my generation grew up with?
I think so. The ones with the foam costumes.
Yeah.
I watched two.
Now, this new version is all CGI.
Yeah.
Better or worse?
Depends on your viewpoint. If you like the whole campy version, the more kid-centric, go with the foam costumed.
Yep.
If you like action and, like,
terrible computer-generated graphics.
They're not terrible.
Okay.
But if you like action rather than campy, go with the new one.
Rating?
It's rated PG-13 as well.
Okay, anything else on DVD? I know you'd mentioned there was a Jason Smith title out.
Kevin Smith, sorry.
Yeah. Kevin Smith.
Tusk.
What is this movie even about? Some people think it's a Japanese horror film. Other people think it's a campy film, like you said. What are we looking at?
It is far from campy. Kevin Smith, very
talented director. And actor.
And actor, mostly known for his raunchy comedies, like Mallrats, Clerks. This is his horror flick. It's about Wallace Brighton. He's a podcaster who gets abducted when he goes to interview a man who claims to have been saved by a whale, or walrus, sorry. And the guy who was saved tries to turn Wallace into a walrus.
Well, don't give away too much, but what's your take? Now, this is rated R.
Yeah.
All right. Is it a horror film?
It's a very gory horror film.
So that one's rated R. That's not one for the kids, but it is available here at our local video distributor.
I actually don't think it is right now.
Or it might be very soon. Maybe next Tuesday.
Yeah, maybe soon.
Okay. Now, one film that is out and drawing much attention is The Interview, which was released in a select number of theaters, but also online. Have you checked out to see if it's available? Because the talk was that the sites had been cyber attacked.
Yeah, I've seen it available on YouTube. Google Play Store. I think to rent it, it's like $6 on the Google Play Store, yep. Which
so
if you're really wanting to watch this film, that's a good
place. Do you
want
to watch it?
I do. I want to see what the whole fuss is about. Okay. I want to know why there was so much controversy. Well, I know why.
It's also pretty unique that we can simultaneously watch a movie here in Dillingham as soon as folks in Anchorage get to see it at the theater.
Yeah.
So that's fun.
Yeah, all right. Pretty much.
Anything else coming out? Trailers that you are enjoying?
This month has been a huge month for trailers.
Why?
Star Wars Episode 7.
When does it come out?
They're looking for next December,
mm-hmm.
and it's just been blowing up the internet. Like, everybody is talking about this trailer. They're so excited. I'm actually really excited because they're mixing, like, the old with the new. They got some of the old crew, Mark Hamill.
Does it look as poorly made as the ones that came out a decade ago or so?
It looks astounding.
Awesome.
Like,
well, Elijah Hunt, our student intern at KDLG, intern, back to work.
All right.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for this week's Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. I'm your host, Dave Benninger. Thanks for joining us.